irrigation. On the double! This was when Rorg realized that such delicious raspberries were no more than artificially flavored illusions conjured up by some orcish shamans. Enemies. The children tried to run away, but the sudden drowsiness literally knocked them off their feet. It seemed like a moment had passed, and their eyes rolled back treacherously, making the little ogre fall asleep.
"I'll ask you again," the orc yelled in his face. "How do we get past the sentries? Well?"
The interrogation was in its second hour. Rorg remained stubbornly silent, understanding very well that if he divulged the way into the canyon, his whole tribe could just as well be struck from this world. Long, long ago, mages had sealed the entrance with a special spell lost to time, so the orcs, who owned the local lands, could do absolutely nothing about their ogre neighbors. The shamans merely scratched their heads, powerless to breach the seal.
"If you don't answer, we'll kill her," roared an executioner, and threw back the curtain.
Behind it, fettered to a post like Rorg, was Gragza. It took the children a mere glance to understand that allowing the orcs to reach their beloved mother, their baby sister, who had only recently learned to toddle, and their granddad, who had taught them how to wield a spear, was out of the question, even if they were tortured in front of each other. Better they than their entire kin.
"As you like,"
grinned the orc with a bloody smile, and reached for a sharp-looking implement.
"Let's hear the sound of ogre piglets squealing."
"They died, yet did not betray their people,"
drawled the girl, yawning. Try as I might, I hadn't been able to avoid the worst in our collaborative fairy tale. The grim child had killed the little ogres with her last sentence. I had been planning on telling of how the parents had battled the orcs to save their children. But, yes, they killed them. Since then, all ogres venerate the two children who refused to betray their people and gave their lives in the process. I finished the tale, and with astonishment looked up to find the plague slumbering peacefully. Having come up with such a bloody ending to the tale, she had placed her head on my knee and fallen asleep. It looked like she was having a nice dream, because such an open and kind smile would have been impossible if she had been beset by nightmares. Maybe she was dreaming of her family again beside her, as if no nightmare in a dragon's guise had ever visited her. Who knew? I didn't want to move for fear of disturbing the child's sleep, so I got some alexandrite from my bag, equipped my crafting items, and entered design mode. Why not try and craft two battle ogres, which, in effect, are little children who didn't listen to their parents but overcame all pain. Two ogre pups who went to their deaths for the lives of their own people. It really was a fairy tale worthy of ending up on the chessboard. The projections of two little ogres immediately appeared before my eyes. Typically grim, at the moment they were smiling as if happy with the world. It was as if they had just eaten some delicious raspberries, and life seemed to them cloudless and wonderful. I didn't even have to put much work into shaping them. The figurines were already perfect. Adding the alexandrite to the design mode, I tarried for a moment, afraid of waking the girl, then combined it with the projections. Typically, one figurine would take me several days, so the girl should have long since woken up and run away. After all, I was a dragon.
"Congratulations.
You have advanced along the path of recreating the legendary chess set of Emperor Carmandant, founder of the Malabar Empire. Wise and just, the Emperor offered his opponents the opportunity to settle their disputes with him over the chessboard instead of on the field of battle. Each type of chess piece was made from a different stone. Pawns, the Malachite Orc Warriors, creator, Mayan, and Lapis Lazuli Dwarf Warriors, creator, Mayan. Rooks, the Alexandrite Battle Ogres, creator, Mayan, and Tanzanite Giants. Knights, a war lizard of tourmaline and a war horse of amethyst. Bishops, troll archers of emerald and elf archers of aquamarine. Queens, an orc shaman of peridot and an elemental human archmage of sapphire. Kings, the head of the white wolf clans, an orc of green diamond, and the emperor of the Malabar Empire, a human of blue diamond. The chessboard, black onyx and white opal, framed in white and yellow gold. Numbers and letters on the chessboard, platinum. After the death of the emperor, the chess set was destroyed. Now it remains only to your skill whether Barleona will again see this truly great wonder of the world, the legendary chess set of Emperor Carmandant. You have created the Alexandrite Battle Ogres from the legendary chess set of Emperor Carmandant. While the chess pieces are in your possession, you will regenerate 1% of your hit points, mana, and energy per minute. This in addition to your standard regeneration. Plus 30 attractiveness to all NPCs younger than 18. Skill increase. Plus 1 to crafting. Total 9. Plus 5 to primary profession of jewel crafting. Total 114. You created a legendary item. Your reputation with all previously encountered factions has increased by 500.
You are no dragon, said a child's voice beside me.
I turned to see the plague, observing me intently.
My name is Gerda. That's what my mom called me.
Hello, Gerda. It's nice to make your acquaintance. Like I already told you, I'm Mayan, a dragon.
Dragons can't turn into people,
Gerda stated, with such assurance that you could have taken her for a specialist on this race.
Therefore, you are not a dragon. No point in trying to fool me.
Okay, and what if I do this? I got to my feet and changed forms. I heard a suppressed squeal, and Gerda fell to the ground and began to scrape it with her feet as she tried to crawl away from me. The child's face displayed such a sincere horror that I instantly turned back into human form and shook my head, not daring to approach the girl. There you go. When I'm in human form, you're not scared of me. As soon as I become myself, you become terrified.
Was that really you?
Gerda asked indecisively, halting her back pedal.
Again, not all dragons are evil,
and not all people are good. Look, I'll turn into a dragon again, and you try your best not to get scared. Deal?
I will try,
the girl replied, on the verge of tears. What I liked the most, though, was that the grown-up voice that had so unsettled me when we had first met had gone. At the moment, standing before me was an ordinary small child who was simply terrified of dragons, which was pretty normal.
Oh!
exclaimed Gerda, as soon as I turned into a dragon again. However, this time she didn't collapse and try to escape.
Say something, please,
asked the girl, stuttering from the terror that still possessed her.
It's the same old me in a different form, I reassured her.
You can approach me and poke me with your finger. Do you want me to give you a ride? We can fly around like birds. I recalled the recent episode with Lana.
We can fly?
The child's eyes flashed, and she took a step towards me.
Like birds?
I swear on Iluna. I am Dragon Man, and I will do everything I can to return you to the earth in one piece if you take me up on the offer. If you get scared, I will land immediately. May Iluna be my witness. I don't wish to cause you any harm. I don't know what the developers had spiked this imitator's logic with, but the probability that the girl might think something ill of me was very high. He's offering me a ride so that he can throw me off, or scare me so bad my heart will stop. Dragons are like that, after all. It was only when an aura appeared around me, indicating that the goddess had accepted my words, that the child took a second, uncertain step in my direction. Then another one, and another. Trembling like a leaf in the breeze, afraid to lift her head, the little girl was standing beside me, shifting from foot to foot. I stayed silent, unwilling to prod her to a final decision, and waited to see which would triumph. The girl's hate of dragons, or her desire to soar among the clouds.
"But how am I supposed to climb atop you?"
asked the girl after several minutes, placing with a slight tremble her hand on my paw. Sprawling down onto the earth, I let her mount on my neck and carefully, as if afraid to drop her, rose up into the air.
Ding!
"You have failed your trial," proclaimed a bombastic voice.
No sooner had I landed and allowed the giddy child dismount safely to the ground than a light flashed before my eyes, and I found myself back in the enormous hall piled with treasures.
"You are unworthy of the title of Dragon of the Blue Flame. Just like your father in his later years, you are spineless, good-natured, and rely only on conscience and feelings, instead of reason and loyalty to your race. As sons of the dragon who once founded this order, you are permitted to take with you his armor and select no more than one item for yourself. After that, the doors to this treasure vault will shut themselves to you forever."
Quest received: a heartfelt conversation. Description: travel to Viltorax and speak with the head of the dragons to discover the truth about the times of the dragon's grandeur. Quest type: unique to your race. Quest reward: variable. Penalty for failing or refusing the quest: none. Renox's armor and one additional item? Or, considering that Draco is my totem, two items? Instead of getting my restless little paws on the entire treasure vault, I'm supposed to content myself with just two toys? How was I supposed to do that unfortunate trial in order to pass it? Kill the girl? What would be the point of that? She no longer hates dragons, and therefore the rest of my brood should survive. Was I wrong to persuade her? And what is the significance of the statement that I am unworthy of the title of Dragon of the Blue Flame? How am I spineless? What a bunch of nonsense. In my heart of hearts, I can sense that Renox owes me one very unpleasant for him conversation. Dragon armor set acquired. Description: the set is tied to your dragon form and may not be removed or altered while in human form. The wearer of the armor set takes 40% less damage and flies 30% faster. Set type: unique to the race. Requirements: dragon rank 5 or higher. All right. The set is clear to me. In effect, having allowed me to reach the fifth dragon rank, the developers allowed me to put on a uniform befitting of my new rank. I can't take it off, and there's nothing to switch it for. From this angle, I'm happy with the outcome. From another, hell, from any other angle, I'll have to leave the treasure vault untouched and unpilfered. A single item can hardly be missed around here. The voice remained silent, so I began to walk along the mounds of items, trying to look away from the gold. I can just sense that the single item will be a gold one. No one's about to let me haul away a pile as one item. So I'll have to select an item that I know will come in handy right now, as well as later when I level up. The only answer to this is an item with crafting. "May I reorganize the items in here?" I inquired, realizing that I could spend a long time digging in these caverns. "I'd like to place all items with crafting in one pile so that I can make an informed decision and not have to poke my finger at the first chain or ring I come across. Can that be done?"
"Choose on your own," came the response, in whose voice I caught a note of true pleasure at my quandary.
Oh, boy. This guy's a jerk on top of it all. All it took was one glance at a rare breastplate with such characteristics that my heart skipped a beat for me to understand that several incredibly unpleasant hours lay ahead. The breastplate of intellect that I saw would serve a player of level 330, so Stacy, for example, would never say no to it. I would surely profit with another kiss for such a generous present, and yet I wanted to find something for myself. But how was I supposed to find items with crafting among these mountains of stuff? Would I really have to turn everything upside down?
"Brother, look at this armor I got!"
Draco popped up beside me, all shimmering in his new outfit. Judging by its characteristics, he had received the same set I had, so now my totem would be 40% harder to kill than before. Very pleasant news, that.
"I heard you're looking for crafting items?" asked Draco when I was about to truly despair. "While you were away doing your trial, I looked through the majority of the stuff around here and only found one item with crafting. And what an item it is! I don't even know how to describe it to you. You have to see it with your own eyes. Let's go!"
Turning into my dragon form and finding to my surprise that my timer had long since elapsed, that is, according to the rules, I was no longer allowed to transform, I flew behind my totem.
"There!"
Draco scowled joyfully, pointing with his paw at a small source of light shrouded by a piece of cloth. Flying up to it, I discovered that the light source was actually a smith's hammer, similar to the one I had in my smithing set. When I cast aside the fabric, I was forced to squint. So bright, relative to the dusk of the treasure vault, was its illumination. When the light ceased to hurt my eyes, I checked the hammer's characteristics and froze.
"Gladir of Borg Goldhand. Description. In the Black Maw, Borg Goldhand encountered a sage being that endowed him with its wisdom and helped him forge this hammer. Seven masters of the Undermountain Kingdom used Gladir to create the legendary Radiant Set, the Pride of the Dwarves. Plus 5 to crafting. Item class, legendary."
"The second son has made his choice," said the voice,
and the air around me began to move as though I had found myself in the middle of a small tornado.
"The doors to this treasure vault are shut to you forevermore. Now
It is the turn of the Founder's first son to choose. He who should not exist, but was reincarnated into a totem's form.
"Who should not exist?"
asked Draco with surprise and halted his circling.
"What do you know about the exile of the dragons?"
the voice suddenly asked, as if it wished to have a chat. Considering its earlier tone, this was strange indeed.
"There was no exile."
It was my turn to be surprised.
"The dragons left this world, for they had completed all their duties as guardians."
"Never were the dragons the guardians of this world,"
parried the voice.
"All the races that flooded Malabar in the ancient times, when the dragons soared through the skies, were their slaves. It is impossible to be the keeper of slaves. One can only be their master. And so the dragons were. The pitiful sheep were slaughtered without quarter or mercy. Masters don't need the unwilling. This world was destined to become a world where the dragons were deities. But then Iluna interfered. No one knows what happened between her and Aranoxitalicus, but suddenly he transformed into one of those slaves whom he had formerly annihilated. He became soft, sensitive, thoughtful, gathering around himself those who thought like him over the course of centuries. The head of the most powerful clan in this world left it, leaving it all behind. Iluna prohibited their return, while a hunt ensued throughout Barleona after those that remained. Over the course of 2 millennia, practically all of the dragons were exterminated.
Practically? It was my turn to be surprised. You mean to say that there is still a living dragon somewhere in Barleona?
Not just one. On this continent as well as on others. They froze and changed. But just like in the ancient times, they remain true to the ideals of the dragons of the blue flame. Unlike their exiled brethren.
What does exile have to do with it? The dragons left, and that's a fact. Even in your own account, there's no mention of exile. Renox left on his own, taking with him those dragons that chose the path of reason. No one exiled them.
He was exiled by his own breed. Once he submits to be governed by his feelings, a dragon loses his right to life. And Renox, as you call him, knew this better than the rest. He was the one who came up with this law and followed it for many thousands of years. Unable to return to this world, Renox began to influence it, striking from the memories of sentience any mention of the dragon's dominion and substituting them with fairy tales about guardians. The short-lived ones have a tendency to forget everything quickly, even their own humiliation, even their own triumph, though the latter never occurred. After 2 generations, everyone believed that the dragons were the guardians of Barleona, forever forgetting their own slavery. Even the elves struck the dragon's rule from their chronicles, leaving but a brief mention of their existence. Renox is most guilty of the fall of the dragon race. And now, two of his sons, one adopted, the other reborn, dare stand here and demand a reward.
Why shouldn't I exist?
Draco repeated his question.
Ask your father. He will tell you many interesting things. For example, the manner of your death.
He died battling the ice giants, I exclaimed, recalling my conversation with Renox.
I don't intend on praising or denigrating the apostate. He must tell you the truth himself, about his exile and his son's role in it,
said the guardian, ending the conversation. Well, here we are then. Everything that I knew until then about dragons was that they were wise, caring, and utterly unmalicious flying lizards that, for whatever reason, were warring with the Sirens, the Cyclops, and, unless I'm mistaken, the Titans. My first encounter with Renox had only confirmed this fact. The Green One had seemed to me not only a wise, but also a truly generous dragon. The coordinates of two dungeons in which one could find treasures gathered over many generations by the dragons was a truly majestic gift for a player like me. And in the end, I couldn't even complete the first dungeon, having failed my trial. Something tells me that I would have failed it no matter what. The developers would never make the mistake of providing a prisoner the key to his liberty. The sale of even half of what was located in this hall would allow me to buy my freedom as well as that of my officers. It followed that this dungeon was impassable by definition, and had been conceived with a single goal of equipping me with the proper dragon gear. It followed that, for my constructive interaction with the girl, I was also granted the bonus of Gladir and another as yet unselected item. However, not even in a drunken stupor would I have imagined that the dragons were the scourge of Malabar, or that all peoples and races groaned beneath their yoke, or that to see a dragon in times past was an ill omen. I'm not even sure whether I should share the video I recorded with Anastaria. This kind of truth I have little desire to publish. Let everyone go on thinking that the dragons are guardians. Besides, Renox did try to stop Garenika when he froze the players near Beatwick Village. All in all, I would need to speak with the giant green lizard before I made any decisions.
As soon as your totem chooses an item, the doors to this treasure vault will close to you forevermore. Niliagnus, make your selection.
The voice returned to its earlier bombast. Niliagnus?
Your totem has gained a level. Your totem has gained a level. Your totem has gained a level.
Niliagnus. Slowly, a syllable at a time, echoed my level 54 totem. Over the past hour, Draco had grown to span 3 meters from his nose to his tail's tip, and now bore utterly no resemblance to the tiny lizard that I had received several months ago. Rolling his name along his tongue, a name more befitting an elf than a dragon, Draco was at once looking at me and through me, deep in thought. I had never seen my totem in such a pensive state. It seemed that his old imitator was being formatted and a new one installed. A new imitator that could answer for the actions of this updated, upgraded dragon.
"Brother, I..."
began Draco. No, Niliagnus. No, I will call him Draco, after all. He breathed a deep sigh as if gathering his courage and then blurted out,
"Call me Draco, like before, okay? I believe that my name is Nelirgenus, my real name, but I like the name you came up with. I am Draco, a dragon's totem. If that's all right with you, of course."
"Of course it's all right with me," I replied. "You will always be Draco to me. By the way, you were telling me about some amazing item you found. Will you show it to me?"
"Yep. Almost forgot. Let's go. It's not far. I've never seen anything like it before. Even in this treasure vault, it's like a diamond in a dump. But why am I mincing words? Come and see for yourself. Let's take it."
Staring at the item that Draco was twirling around, I couldn't contain my laughter. Way to go, developers! I would never have anticipated such a bold move. A metallic, silvery sphere that resembled a basketball by its dimensions, entirely solid without so much as a hint of an opening, a groove, or a crack. Simply a large metallic thing, a giant ball bearing. The totem was right. In a treasure vault brimming with weapons, equipment, and gold, this thing really did seem misplaced.
"You've made your choice," said the guardian of the treasure vault, and Draco and I were lifted into the air.
A portal appeared right beneath the ceiling, and the whirlwind that had formed around us began to pull us towards it. Yet I remained fixated on the characteristics of this new item in my bag, and paid no attention to our journey out of the first dragon's dungeon. The item Draco had chosen was simply too wondrous.
The Crastil of Shalar. Description: Rastukal, who snarfed the Prarkot of Rurna, managed to glass the Prelix of Kurlex. Only the Rim's Kerjoplix Girtgirt can take the Crastil of Shalar. Item class, unique.
I really hope that this actually means something, because otherwise... Chapter 6. The Blood Ritual. Even as the sun, with purple-colored face, had ta'en his last leave of the weeping morn, "Thrice fairer than myself," thus she began, with this she seizeth on his sweating palm, "the field's chief flower, sweet above compare, vouchsafe, thou wonder, to alight thy steed, and rein his proud head to thy saddle-bow. A summer's day will seem an hour but short." "Sick," thoughted Venus, "makes amain unto him, more white and red than doves or roses are. Being so enraged, desire doth lend her force, courageously to pluck him from his horse. Saith that the world hath ending with thy life, and like a bold-faced suitor gins to woo him, and kissing speaks with lustful language broken." I reread the Riddle of the Ogres several times, unable to understand what Shakespeare's timeless Venus and Adonis had to do with the Carmondant chess set. Not only were the verses presented out of order, but even their unscrambled combination did not yield the result I could recite from memory. Another thing I liked very much about the riddle was that the first 8 verses were in one ogre, while the other 8 were in the other, and there was no field for entering the answer. It was as if the answer, as such, did not exist.
"Hi, man, it's me."
Around evening, Anastaria got in touch with me through the amulet.
"Do you have plans tonight?"
"I do. There was this one girl who promised to go on a date with me. I'm waiting for her invitation."
"Forget her. She's lame and late.
I intend on snatching you from her. What do you think of taking a ride down one of the canals of romantic nighttime Annhers?
When and where?
If you must talk, leave the library,
muttered the grizzled keeper of the shamanic book.
People come here to acquire learning, not wag their tongues.
Who's that mighty terror I hear in the background? Are you even in Annhers?
Yes, I'm at the shaman's.
Then meet me in 5 minutes at the entrance. I'll be giving you a master class on how to properly go on a date tonight. I'll be waiting.
When the girl disconnected, I stood up from the only chair and stretched. Having killed almost the entire day in acquainting myself with the book, I had raised my spirituality to 72. I still had a quarter of the book left, so I could be confident of increasing this stat a little more, though I had not the slightest idea of what I would do afterwards. Was my subsequent growth as a shaman supposed to rely exclusively on summoning combinations of spirits? Because that would take forever.
"Are you going to go on with the quiet game much longer?"
asked Anastaria, as soon as we settled ourselves in the magic-steered gondola. "Silent game?" I asked, surprised, still overwhelmed with my impressions from my day's reading. I had seldom encountered such complex and at the same time fascinating language. The gist of the meaning was sometimes so convoluted that I had to read over and over again the same piece of text to understand what the author was trying to say. It was like constantly being interrupted by the pop-ups of some insidious malware. I got the impression that more than one author had worked on the book.
"Yesterday, a player created the ogres from the Carmandant set. You wouldn't happen to know who that may be. Our clan could use someone crafty like him."
"Oh, that's what you're on about," I smiled, and, retrieving the figurines, offered them to Stacy. "How do you like this riddle?"
"Hmm,"
muttered the girl, utterly oblivious to the beauties of the evening capital around us. I'd wager my head that, at the moment, the world she was in contained nothing besides the two figurines.
"So, where are you supposed to write the answer?"
"You already solved it?" Hearing Stacy's words, I almost had a culturally induced heart attack.
Had it really taken her a mere hum, hmm, and a so to solve the riddle?
But that's impossible.
How can a person be so perfect
in both outward appearance and inner aptitude?
"No, but if I had, where would I enter it?"
The girl dispelled my doubts. She was human, after all. Returning the figurines, Stacy added,
"Give me a day, and I will solve this riddle. But listen, Mayan, could you please tell me, what is your name?"
"My name?"
"It's just that constantly referring to a person by his in-game handle is a little... well, I personally don't much enjoy it when people refer to me as Anastaria. Stacy, Anastasia, and for a select few, Stace. That's my name, and I love it very much, so I've grown accustomed to addressing other players by their real name, not the one they cooked up when they made the account. Or would you rather it remain unknown?"
"No, not at all. Simply, no one's ever asked about it before. My name's Daniel, or simply Dan."
"Wonderful. Then, Dan, show me what else you have that's interesting."
"Huh?"
"Okay, I can get it myself."
Stacy scooted over beside me and stuck her hand into the holy of holies of any player, his private bag. Oh, right. I was going to adjust the access settings to it, but never got around to it.
"Okay,
no point in regretting it now. Stacy didn't seem afflicted by kleptomania anyway.
Danny, you don't mind telling me how you managed to acquire an item that the dwarven king would give half his kingdom for?
Asked Stacy, retrieving Borg's gladiator and brandishing it above her head like a torch. Blazing like the sun and dispersing the encroaching dusk, Gladiator turned the evening into bright noon, allowing us to see the finest details of our gondola and of the masonry that lined the canal's banks. Unable to restrain myself, I began to record a video. The sight unfolding before my eyes was that glorious.
"All right, put it away," said the girl after she had had enough.
She returned it to me without having received an answer from me about where I had acquired the little wonder. Perhaps she was merely saving that conversation for later. After all, besides the gladiator, I also had...
"I'm afraid to ask what that is," said Stacy, taking the crustile of Shalar from the bag.
Spinning the orb in her hands, and at a loss for its purpose, she returned it almost instantly.
"So are you going to tell me, or are you going to play the rebel and force me to interrogate you? I must warn you, my preferred methods are quite sadistic."
With her hot breath, Stacy whispered those last words right in my face.
"You know, I wouldn't mind being a rebel," I managed, trying my best to stay still.
A pretty girl is located no more than several centimeters from me, and if I make even a small nervous step, this bewitching moment might evaporate, and I will surely awake back in my bed in the hotel. For it is incredibly hard to believe that not only is Anastaria here beside me, after all, young women as a rule enjoy being social, but that she is not planning on leaving me.
"Very well,"
meowed my tormentor, holding up a scroll, and a curtain of invisibility shrouded the boat.
"Then the torture shall commence."
I can say only one thing. As a rebel, I'm so-so.
"Altamida,"
said Anastaria pensively, staring into the dating house ceiling.
"I'm still a bit miffed you didn't tell me this right away."
"Stacy, I already explained what happened." Lying beside the girl, I was staring in the same spot she was, albeit seeing something entirely different. Unicorns were prancing, butterflies were flitting, flowers were budding, and a rainbow was shimmering before my eyes. I felt good.
"I know. It's just that, what do you think I was doing this morning instead of jumping into the game? I was looking around for any mention of Urisai. Not just the castle, but anything at all."
"And how'd it go?"
"I only found one thing. Urisai is one of the ancient demons in Naga mythology. The only thing that's known about him is that he was scary. Other than that, there's not a single mention."
"So it follows that..."
"Precisely. This very demon is ensconced in our castle, awaiting our arrival. It's almost too bad they gave us titles. We could have gotten married and entered Altamida together. As it stands, you will have to play the hand that's been dealt us, as per usual."
The girl turned to me and asked me out of the blue,
"Say, Dan, is there a Mrs. Mahon waiting for you somewhere out there in reality, mournfully crossing off day after day in her calendar? I'd like to have an idea of whom I might have to split you with."
"I don't require splitting. I'm a single entity, indivisible. As for Mrs. Mahon, unfortunately, in my 30 years, I haven't been so lucky as to encounter her.
I actually don't have anyone at all. Back there. Out there.
Your parents?
They've been dead 7 years now. Imitators were only introduced to transportation 5 years ago. Although, no, it's 6 now. Prior to that, people would drive on their own, and my parents...
I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
It's no big deal. Actually, Stacy, I have a similar question for you. Can I call you my girl, or is what happened today a terrible secret to be kept sealed under 7 seals, lest, Iluna forbid, Mr. Anastar finds out about it? I just realized I don't know your last name.
Not many do,
the girl replied, moving closer to me.
My name is Anastaria Zvkaya,
and I'd be happy to be your girlfriend.
Sounds like some kind of promise or something.
But you still haven't answered my question.
I'm not sure how to answer it. Officially, I'm not spoken for. However, there is a person who has grown accustomed to thinking of me as his bride.
Bride? I even did a double take at this dramatic confession.
Yeah. In all, I've had 3 boyfriends. The most famous of them was Hellfire. Oh, don't look at me like that. When you spend a very long time with a man, sooner or later you begin to feel sympathy for him. We spent almost 4 years together, and I finally understood that you can't change Hell. Hellfire and compromise are 2 utterly different concepts, belonging to different universes. So we split. Or, more accurately, I left him. I don't think Hell has let me go yet. To this day, he believes I belong to him. Sends me gifts and invitations to meet up in the game, as well as in reality. At some point, I even wanted to leave Phoenix, but Dad stopped me.
Dad? I echoed, trying to straighten my contorted face. Despite our current relations, I didn't want to reveal the information I had.
Well, yeah, Eckler, the head of Phoenix. I doubt I could have managed to accomplish much in this game if it weren't for him. From the very outset, he would invite me to clan meetings. He taught me and forced me to think for myself. It was he who insisted that I receive 2 higher degrees and work toward a 3rd. It was he who made me head of analytics for Phoenix, even though 7 years ago, when I started there, I made such logical blunders that I blush now to remember them. He made me into the Anastaria that Barleona knows, so I feel nothing but gratitude for him.
How did he lose you to me, then?
Do you think he had a choice? He and I decided long ago that I was free to go off on my own whenever I felt like it, and that I could always return to Phoenix if I wanted to, too. By the way, do you know why it's called Phoenix? You're about to become the 3rd person inducted into a global secret. Phoenix was the name of the dog that lived with us for 30 years and passed only a couple before Barleona was launched. My dad loved the old guy so much that he named the clan in his honor. Everyone calls us fried chickens, but he and I just laugh remembering Phoenix. He loved chicken very much.
We spent the next 3 hours speaking, improvising a vacation for ourselves by ignoring the clan chat and our mailboxes. We asked each other about everything we could think of, beginning with what schools we had attended and ending with who thought what about the other when Anastaria and Hellfire first caught me near the tin ore outside of Beatwick. Embraced, we lay in the dating house, playing the game of truth. I never considered this an interesting game until I played it with a person whom I liked so much.
I don't know what's even more interesting, to listen or to tell. Both were unbelievably pleasant. The next morning found me in the jewelry workshop. 2 days remained until the trip to the werebeasts. Barca and Anastaria were occupied with recruitment. Plinto was doing something unpleasant with the raiders. The chap periodically registered complaints about his orders. Eric had submitted himself to the Emperor and was engrossed in leveling up his smithing. I didn't know what Leidy and Klutzer were up to, but I was sure they too had business. So exercising my privilege as clan head, I dropped everything, equipped my crafting items, including my brand new gladiator, and got down to work. After the night with Stacy, I was filled with such emotions that even the bartender NPC, who would typically occupy the bar in the hotel, inquired with surprise why I was suddenly glowing. Design mode greeted me with its customary dimness. Divided in several blocks, it contained all the images and items I had recently worked on. Wire, rings, chains, amulets, everything that I could recreate took up the majority of the workspace. Each block, in turn, was divided by item class, rare, epic, unusual, allowing me to find the item I needed to recreate as quickly as possible. Another block contained those players that I had created in the cursed chess set, all 32 people, almost half of whom were no longer in Malabar. The shelf of unique items, which I could never recreate, was located beside the player's block. Virtual images of chess pieces, Kamehameha, the Ring of Drial, and the cursed chess set. Despite their simplicity, these objects drew my attention, making it hard to ignore them. A funny name for them popped into my head. Goodiness. I am so happy that these virtual images can't be taken from me, that, recalling the dragon Smaug, who so relished his gold, I too basked in their beauty. I would have to do something about that, or else some hobbit might appear and strip me of my design mode. That would be quite bad. I had already rendered Anastaria several times, so two girls instantly appeared before me. One of the cursed chess pieces, who regarded the world with a haughty gaze, and another, a prototype for the Amulet of the Novice, kind, white, and soft. It was this image that I decided to work with now. I had no goal in mind, so I decided to surrender to the will of inspiration and the imitator of jewel crafting. The time had come to rate me as a jeweler. Everything I had created until then was no more than dust, since it had been created either per a quest or per the developer's instructions. Now, however, I wished to make something truly unheard of, something that would really demonstrate how I feel about the most wonderful girl I have ever met in my life. First of all, I'd need a base, a tree's branches and leaves interwoven and forming... No, that won't do. Better let it be flowers. That's it, long flowers, interwoven to form a garland. Roses? Let's try it. No, roses won't do. Sea thistles, then. That's it. Once upon a time, this flower was the clan's symbol, and I had grown fond of it. So now it will serve as something else. Intricate blossoms, long, thin stalks, to weave a garland, and a dash of blue reflecting the sky. What could be lovelier? The sea thistle appeared right before my eyes, as if it had been waiting for me to remember it. The first difficulties began almost instantly, as soon as I began trying to shape the garland. I didn't know how to properly interweave the flowers. It wasn't difficult to multiply the sea thistles, but to form them into one object. Here, the wire came in handy. I simply wound it about the flowers, arranging the blooms one after the other.
The ensuing garland was less ovoid or round than heart-shaped. Perhaps my subconscious feelings about Anastaria were playing their part? Yes, I seem to have missed my mark, but okay, I'm still happy with it for now. I decided to fashion the rim of the heart with thick wire woven into a braid. Having made a loop for the chain, I got down to the hardest and most laborious part of my idea, mounting the girl's image on the flowery heart. The white, fluffy, and wonderful Anastaria. No sooner had I focused my gaze on the girl's projection than she began to float, turning into the already familiar priestess of Iluna. On my 10th attempt, I obtained my desired result and realized that this was just no good. I would have to attach the image to the flowers first, and only then adjust its appearance. The idea didn't work out. I placed the girl's projection on the flowery heart and frowned. False, ugly, and banal. Stacy didn't look good at all against a background of blue flowers. She was like, well, bull in a china shop doesn't really fit here, but that was roughly the idea. It's not right to depict a player on a game item unless you want the item to be binding. I was about to turn my back on my idea when an excellent thought occurred to me. I didn't need a binding. I could do something utterly different. Anastaria's image returned to its prior place, and I refocused my attention on the garland. As regrettable as it is to admit it, but I had overdone it. The center of the heart would have to be empty. Then I could mount the figurines within it. Biting my lip from aggravation at having to destroy that which took so much labor to create, I fairly quickly cut out the internal part, leaving, nevertheless, a fairly thick band of flowers. All the same, enough sea thistles remained. Inside the space formed in this manner, I decided to draw two figures, Anastaria and myself. It's not very modest of me, of course. However, to my surprise, the greatest difficulty arose not with Anastaria's image, but with mine. I had seen myself only several times, and had missed several details. The length of my wings, the shape of my face, my ears. I could perfectly recall the siren, but my image as a dragon required me to use my imagination. When the interwoven shapes of the dragon and the siren had been placed inside the floral heart, the pendant was complete. A mere trifle remained. To add to the design tool the items I was going to make the pendant out of. The rim would be made of bronze, of which I had several ingots in my bag. The sea thistles from lapis lazuli, of which I also had plenty. As for the images of the dragon and the siren, the supreme spirits had punished me by giving me the yin-yang, the stone that I would bear until the end of days, or until I come up with some use for it. Taking another glance at the figures of the siren and the dragon, standing beside each other, I understood that I knew now how to use the stone of opposites. It was difficult to imagine two more opposed essences than a dragon and a siren. Item created. Monteletti, the pendant of Antipodes. Description. Ere olden times, the dragon and the siren stood as foes, seeking to vanquish the other at first sight. But it came to pass that dragon Julianox encountered siren Romeolix. Twixt them inflared a sentiment implausible, thanks to which they overcame all obstacles placed on their journey to happiness. When the item is in the inventory or on the character, +15 attractiveness to all NPCs, +5% to all main character stats. The item may be worn as an accessory and does not occupy a slot. Item class, unique. Limitations,
item is crafted from the yin-yang stone. You created a unique item. Your reputation with all encountered factions has increased by 500. Plus 5 to jewel crafting, total 119. Plus 1 to crafting, total 10.
The clap of a teleport sounded in my workshop as a portal opened several feet away from me and Anastaria emerged from it.
"Thank you, Reptilis,"
she said to the wall, which was utterly empty. Or it seemed to me that there was nothing there, for a moment later the wall came to life, and I found myself facing one of my acquaintances. Kobold Reptilis, level 147, assassin. How quickly this guy is growing. Only several months ago, when we last met in Farstad, he was still a good ways away from 100.
"But why are you here instead of a henchman?"
"Because everyone is equal in my clan," barked the crocodile. "And the clan head has to sit in ambush just like the rank and file. Otherwise, he loses his skills. That's it. I'm transferring you this body alive and well. There were no incidents to speak of during my watch. He was a peaceful object of regard."
"Best of luck," said Anastaria to the kobold's back.
Strange. As I recall, this guy was a fan of Anastaria's, and yet now he's so calm about her company that you could think that in the intervening time he'd met that one unique and irreplaceable woman who became his own personal ideal. But what could prompt Stacy to hire me a bodyguard? "Hi," I smiled at the girl, who tarried beside the still-open portal.
"Have you finished?"
the girl asked calmly, and yet her words struck me with the force of thunder. There was neither the shade of emotion nor a touch of interest in what I had made in them. The girl was looking me in the eyes, and in her look I read no hint of joy at our meeting. To the opposite, I read in them reproach.
"Get your stuff. We're expected."
"I think I'll step out," said the jewelcraft master suddenly, remembering that he had cows to milk and pigs to feed in the neighboring room. He left me one-on-one with Stacy.
"What's the problem, Stacy? Yes, I popped out of the game for a day, but that doesn't mean I need a bodyguard, and definitely doesn't deserve your displeasure."
"Doesn't deserve?"
Anastaria half sang, slightly tilting her head.
"You consider 6 days of absence to be insufficient reason to be worried?"
"What?" It was my turn to be astonished. Opening the calendar, I stared dumbly at the current date. If I recall, when I sat down to work, there really were 6 days difference. The clan meeting I missed was blinking in the calendar, the same one I had set and the same one I had missed, as was becoming habit now. But how?
"Dan, how much more of this? Yes, I hired a guard and, while I was at it, an informer so that he could tell me when you returned."
Judging by her accusatory tone, Stacy was beginning to thaw.
"By the third day, the forums were bristling with claims that the head of the Legends of Barleona had crashed, that you were an imitator and not a player."
"What a bunch of claptrap," I replied haltingly, trying to figure out how I had lost 6 whole days. For me, the process of creating the pendant had taken only a couple hours. Meanwhile, in Barleona, a whole week had passed. Considering that our clan is short for time, I really did pick a good moment to be absent.
"I was making you a present." "A present?"
"Here." I offered the girl the amulet I had crafted. I don't know what people typically say in such situations, so, well, take it. Nothing augured misfortune. But hardly had Anastaria taken the pendant in her hands when a light show erupted in the jewelry workshop. Golden winds enwrapped us, and everything grew bright, like when a unique item was created. The sudden bluster scattered the tables, instruments, and materials, knocked down the shelves, and ripped out the chandelier from the workshop ceiling, hurling it mercilessly out the window. All that remained of it was now slowly tumbling along the floor in the form of little candle fragments.
"What are you doing? Why, heck!" came the voice of the gnome in response to the clatter.
But as soon as he opened the door, he was immediately knocked back by a massive grinding wheel. The door shut behind him, and chairs and a table piled onto it. After several minutes, two people remained standing in the center of the tornado that was smashing the workshop to smithereens, Anastaria and I. Objects were hurling past us like specters. The wind, which by that point had ripped off the roof, completely ignored the couple looking into each other's eyes. When the floor under our feet fell away with a horrible screech and flew off after the roof, leaving us suspended in midair, I took a step toward the girl. As if prompted by her own premonition, Stacy, too, took a step toward me. Clods of earth began to rush past us. The floor was long gone, but the walls, as surprising as it was, held on. The door that had hidden the jeweler was thrown ajar, and I could see that the chaos in the neighboring room was no less severe than in ours, although the floor and ceiling there still remained. As for the gnome, he was nowhere to be seen. Either he had fled, or he had flown off after the roof, or maybe he was hiding behind the giant dresser, the last remaining piece of furniture.
"This is for you, love," I said, taking Anastaria's hands in mine. Gazing into her hazel eyes, I couldn't care less that the girl had been angry with me only a few seconds ago, nor that in a fit of anger she could reject my gift. At the given moment, none of this mattered one bit. For the first time in my life, I sincerely confessed my feelings to a girl, without worrying about the response in the least.
"Thank you, love,"
said Stacy, and, as banal and purple as it sounds, we submerged ourselves into the sweet world of a kiss. It lasted forever. I pressed Anastaria to myself, closed my eyes from pleasure, and we flew off into the heavens. My head was spinning, as though the girl had once more used her amorous charms, which, theoretically, should have no effect on me. Strange images of dragons, sirens, cupids, and hearts spewed forth in my mind, and the rushing wind finally reached us, cooling but not budging us where we stood. Now I understood what the expression, "in seventh heaven," meant, though I'd say I was easily in the 45th. Even the night I had spent with her had not brought me as much pleasure as this kiss.
"It's a bit cold,"
whispered Anastaria after a short while, trying to press herself closer to me and wrapping me with my tail. I covered her with my wings, guarding her from the piercing wind.
"Stop! My tail? Wings? The cold?"
"My son, you dared to bring a siren into our world?"
Renox's thunderous growl resounded among the snow-capped mountains, triggering avalanches, and I realized what is located in the 45th heaven, Viltorax, the homeland of the dragons of Malabar.
"Destroy her,
ordered my virtual father, and a flock of dragons that had been wheeling several hundred meters from us darted in our direction.
"Don't dare touch her!"
Casting a golden shield on Anastaria to protect her from the cold, I soared high into the air to block the way to the siren. The dragons slowed, flapping their wings and looking back for instruction to the giant green Renox. The unheard of had happened. A dragon had stood up to protect his eternal enemy.
"I love Anastaria and don't wish her to be harmed."
Several dragons were so surprised by my words that they even forgot to flap their wings and began falling, like immense boulders, onto the snowy mountain slopes. One of the dragons, however, flapped his wings energetically and appeared beside me in a moment.
Draco!
Making a pirouette, he graciously turned and took his place beside me.
"I am with you, brother,"
my totem assured me, menacingly bristling the spines on his neck.
"The lovers who have caused the yin-yang to bloom deserve help in their struggle for happiness. Hear me, O father!"
Draco yelled to Renox.
"They caused the yin-yang to flower!"
"Everyone back!"
Another wave of avalanches rumbled from the mountains, and Renox landed heavily on the earth.
"Are you sure, son?"
"What's there to be sure about? Take a look yourself,"
said Draco in a satisfied voice, and indicated first mine, then Anastaria's neck.